I'll talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln and some of the mysticism around him when we come back with Dr. John DeSalvo, as well as magic, the Ark of the Covenant, and also the Shroud of Turin. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. John, before we move on to the Ark of the Covenant, let's talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln. He truly was a spiritualist, was he not?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, since I never got my my book out on Lincoln, on my chapter on spiritualism in the Seeress's book, I kind of highlight Lincoln because we know his wife was. You know, Mary Todd was definitely a spiritualist, and he did attend seances, and I have early sources, and I'm not the only one. Others have documented that he was present for probably at least 5 seances, if not more, at the soldiers' home and at the White House. In fact, the Red Room at the White House used to be the seance room, which is very interesting. That's what it was called. That verdict is still out on that. I would think Lincoln scholars do not believe he was a spiritualist. My feeling was he was open to all sorts of things, and I think he felt there was a source of information that he could consider here. And therefore, I don't think he was or wasn't. I think he was just open to it, like we are in many things. You know, we say, well, I'm not sure I really believe that, but I'm open to it, this information and data. But I like talking about Lincoln because, you know, 2009 is his bicentennial anniversary. And the first seance that I was able, that was documented, was in 1862 and of Lincoln. And why this one was, well, I don't know if this is the first one, but why it was significant was because Lincoln had a seance with a 16-year-old girl, a famous medium named Nettie Colburn Maynard. And at that seance, by the way, George, there were a lot of famous people at that time, a congressman from Maine, D. Soames of Massachusetts, John Farnsworth, I think it was of Illinois. And, you know, spiritualism was kind of popular at that time, even the Horace Greeley and William Lloyd Garrison were spiritualists. And so Nettie has this seance with Lincoln, with all these people. And during the seance, she basically says to Lincoln, because don't forget, this is in 1862, just before 1863 in January, when he was supposed to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. And she says to him that the spirits want to make sure you do not delay the enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation beyond the opening year. And she said, we feel that you've gotten pressure to kind of make it law or whatever. And Lincoln basically says, yes, it's taking all my nerve and strength to withstand such a pressure. So basically the spirits then said to him that this is going to be the most important thing and the crowning mark of his administration and his life. And so the question is, did this really have an effect? Would he have still issued it without this? But, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, the famous psychic researcher and inventor of Sherlock Holmes, stated that this meeting between Lincoln and Nettie was one of the most important events in the history of the United States. If you ask me, I don't know. It may not have made a difference, but again, it shows the influence of spiritualism in so many aspects. And then the last documented seance of Lincoln was in 1864. And why I find this one interesting is it almost kind of answers your question. Did he believe it or not? If he didn't believe it, would he have this kind of seance? He had Nettie come to the White House. He told Congressman Soames confidentially, I want this a confidential matter, bring Nettie to the White House. When she arrived, there were 2 soldiers there, 2 older gentlemen, soldiers, and they brought her up into a large room in the White House, and there was a large table with a map of the southern states. And when Nettie came out of her trance, she had a pencil in her hand, and she heard the men saying, the soldiers, it is astonishing, Mr. Lincoln, how she has drawn every line which conforms to the plans we agreed upon. And so Lincoln turned to her and said, it's best not to mention this meeting to anyone. You can keep it confidential. So he actually, you know, asked her, got information about the Civil War, about military plans from her. And if he had no belief in spiritualism, why would he even attempt something like this? So I find that very interesting in terms of, yes, you know, maybe he did have a belief in it, but he didn't say it. He was very much criticized at the time because they believed he received counsel from Andrew Jackson Davis, who was a spiritualist, again, who I wrote my last book about. And so he had to be very careful, especially with the 1864 election coming up, not to, you know, alienate people who thought he was being advised by spiritualists, you know, in that area. So I thought that was very, very interesting, the whole historical implication of spiritualism and Abraham Lincoln, and one of the most important documents in the history of the world, the Emancipation Proclamation.
Absolutely. And you have a relic, you think?
I'm sorry?
You have a relic?
Yeah. Do you want to hear about that story?
Yeah.
This got to be one of the most exciting research adventures of my life.
Word gets around that you have these things, John.
Hey, George, nothing gets by you, huh?
No, nothing.
I remember last time you mentioned something that Joe Parr discovered, and I never even told anybody. So you got some really good sources, my friend. But anyway, I'm a collector of all sorts of things, and I, especially with Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, and in fact, I have a diary that a soldier was in Washington, stationed in Washington, the night of the assassination, and he writes hour by hour what is happening and the information he got. But this was another interesting relic I got, and I got it because it really wasn't documented. Nobody really was exactly sure what it was, so it was able to come into my hands. But it is and I got this pictured on your website. It was very simple. Just it seems like it's like an old piece of lace, you know, measuring about 2.5 inches by about an inch. There's a little note that comes with it. It says Lincoln's bloodstained cloth. And it says from April 15th, 1865, kind of hard to read, presented by Dr. Leal of New York. And that's pretty much all I got to go on, except the person I got it from said it used to be owned by John Hay, who was one of Lincoln's private secretaries. It eventually went to Dr. Robert White. I don't know if you remember his name, the famous Kennedy collector.
Right.
Then it went to this other person who then I got it from. And that was about it. So I decided to, you know, again, being a Lincoln collector, this could be something very significant. So Dr. Leal, as many of your audience probably know, was the first physician to attend Lincoln when he was shot at Ford's Theater. And he was the one who really pretty much took over. In fact, I interviewed Dr. Leal's granddaughter about 5 years ago, Helen Harper Leal, and, you know, asked her about this. And trying to figure out where could this lace have come from, and there were many possibilities. One was it could have been from a dress, could have been Mary Todd's dress. Laura Keene, remember the actress at Ford's Theater, held Lincoln's head in her lap. And unfortunately, the dress has disappeared. There's about 5 pieces, but they don't seem to resemble the piece that I have at all. So I don't think it's from a dress. Could it have been from a pillowcase, a piece of clothing? Some lace institutes analyzed the lace, and they said it's a very fine lace, so they didn't think it would be on something like a bed sheet or a pillow. I'm thinking, you know, from the Peterson House where Lincoln was brought, you know, from Ford's Theater, you know, across the street and laid on the bed in the Peterson House. And so I, you know, spent a good year or so. I, you know, researched the Lincoln Presidential Library, Ford's Theater, all over the place, different resources. And I also found out that Dr. Leal put Lincoln's head on a handkerchief, one of his handkerchiefs that he had. But usually men's handkerchiefs at that time didn't have lace. I did some research into that. If any of your listeners have more information about that, let me know, because that is still a possibility, but it didn't seem likely. So I was kind of at the point where I really wasn't sure exactly where it could have come from. And this is now the reason I put this chapter in the book of the Seeress, not only because of the spiritualism of Lincoln, was because of the idea of using psychometry now. So at this point, I thought, let's try psychometry. And as you know, psychometry is the idea of holding an object and knowing about where it's been or the owner. And, you know, many psychometrists are used my police agencies and to find if they have a piece of a missing person, a clothing or something, and they try to find out, you know, give information about it. So a friend of mine is a semi-retired medical doctor. I was telling him about my Lincoln relic and told me he has a very good friend who's a great psychometrist. I mean, he doesn't do it for a living. He's an engineer. But he said, why don't you come up and we'll and he's living in the Greater Lakes area, Great Lakes area, and bring your relic and we'll have a lunch and see what he says. So I did that, and I gave him the relic and didn't tell him anything about it. He basically said that this definitely had Lincoln's blood on it, and he said it was something the doctors used to try to put on Lincoln's head regarding the bleeding, and it was like a cheesecloth because it was very porous.
Well, that is priceless.
Now, why this is interesting is I then thought, okay, if this is something that Dr. Lill used, what would it have come from? Well, I looked at the pictures of Ford's Theater in the National Archives that were taken the day after, and I looked at Lincoln's booth. And I must have looked at this picture hundreds of times, George, and finally, maybe the 101st time, it dawned on me. The booth Lincoln is at, there's the fine lace curtain on both sides, the fine lace curtain, which you can barely even see in the photograph, unless you have a good photograph, you wouldn't even see it, is missing. But it's on the booth to the left where Lincoln wasn't sitting. So my suspicion was Lill may have ripped a piece of that cloth off to use it to put on the wound. Now, he didn't want to block it off because, you remember, he opened the blood clot up because if the wound was plugged up, Lincoln would stop breathing. So he had to keep it open. But maybe this cloth, because this lace was so porous, he was able to at least put it on there so the blood wouldn't go all over the place. I mean, I don't know his medical reasoning, but that was my thought. So I contacted Ford's Theater, and the supervisor there was just wonderful, helping me out and with other contacts. And I was put in touch with a person named Vincent Messiano, who I think it was back in the 70s got a grant from Congress to reconstruct Ford's Theater based on the Brady photographs. And he had a lace embroidery company in New York and sent me samples of the reconstruction of the curtain in Ford's Theater based on the National Archives photos. And I in my book, I have those. They match so closely, the same leaf pattern, et cetera. So even though I'm not 100% sure that this is a piece of Ford's, the curtain from Ford's Theater, the evidence seems to be pointing to that direction. And I'm hoping to display it next year during the bicentennial at Ford's Theater. I've spoken to them, and they're very interested in having it there in terms of the whole possibility of how, you know, for students, how research can be done on relics. And if this is the only existing piece of Ford's Theater's curtain, I think that's where it belongs. And I would like to see it there, you know, where other people can enjoy it.
Good for you. Hey, I want to get into the Ark of the Covenant. We'll do that after the break. But let's take just a few minutes to talk about magic, even though I know you're working on another work on this. What's your take on magic? I've always been fascinated by it since I was a kid.
Yes. Well, you know, you and I have so much in common. I mean, in terms of our, I was thinking, George, can you imagine when we were kids, if Coast to Coast was on at night, we would have our transistor radio in our bed with our little earphones listening to it.
Yeah, we would have been late for school every day.
I always think of that. But I got into magic because of the script. See, it's always one thing leading me into another, you know, because during the Renaissance period, Dr. John Dee, the famous magician, claimed, and when we talk about magic, I know your audience, we're not talking about magic tricks, but the real magic, you know. John Dee supposedly talked to the angels and wrote in an angelic script, and I have a sample of that in my book. Unfortunately, that doesn't resemble the Seeress' script, so I didn't really get that far, and also Henry Cornelius Agrippa before John Dee. So I was researching the Renaissance magicians, and I, like in anything, George, I like to research it to the best of my ability, and I started studying the different magical systems, from whether it was the Golden Dawn, the OTO, and all the different ones that are out there, and, you know, pretty much on my own, I knew different people involved in this. I got original scans from the British Library of the original D manuscripts and diaries, and it dawned on me that I really believe, and this is where my research is going, that magic really exists. It's a true thing. It is not something of the subconscious, but it's another higher reality. And there are certain areas of the brain. My area of research is in neurophysiology, that there are certain areas of the brain that are receptive, that may be able to open up to these higher planes or these higher areas. Now, this is my speculation.
Sure.
This is where my research I really wanted to go. So the magic I'm focusing on, I think if I write this book, I want it to be called The History, Practice, and Scientific Basis for Magic. Enochian magic appealed to me because that was the magic that Dee received from the angels. It was we have the original diaries of Dee's, his notes and his handwriting that he did these sessions with Edward Kelly. So it's very well documented in the language. And this Enochian magic, which I've been studying very deeply, supposedly one aspect of it, there's 30, he calls them ethers, 30 aethers, like spheres, or worlds that surround our world. And you can enter those by knowing the Enochian calls, the words that the angels gave to him, and the governors who are in charge of those. And through a ritual procedure, you can open them up. And again, I don't advocate this for the average person, even though you can buy books on this stuff. I think, you know, Israel Regardi, the famous magician, said a person should go like a year of psychological counseling before they even attempt any of this, and there's preparations. And so, you know, just as a warning, you know, not something you want to just do on a weekend. You know? But I believe this is part of the key to this angelic language and the angels. And that's why I'm interested. You see, all the things I get involved in tie together. It's really the search for God. And I'm thinking how appropriate. It's already, what, December 24th, because Christmas
Eve. It's moving along, isn't it?
Kind of appropriate to talk about angels and God and the spiritual world and life after death, because that, to me, is the most important meaning of life. And that's where our search should be. So that is what I've been working on. And I, whether I write a book on this or not, I'm not sure whether it just leads to something else. But the Enochian language, see, that's why when you mention the Ouija board and other occult phenomena, yeah. I feel are very dangerous because there's very little control. This type of magic that Dr. D did to me is a little bit more controlled and not as, you know, you're not opening up everything, even though you do have to be careful. So I have some very good people. You had... one of my good friends you have had on your show before, Lon Milo Duquette.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good friend, and is helping me with my research. And I have some very excellent people in this field. That I hope to contact more others that are have written some really good books on it. So I believe here's the bottom line: magic was like the primal language, one of the original methods of spiritual development towards God. And it may have gotten distorted for people using it to want things. I believe the only purpose magic should be used is for spiritual development, not for asking for things. So that, to me, is white magic. You know, and then when you get into manipulating it and using it for selfish reasons, obviously that's black magic. And there's intermediate shades. What if you want to use it to help someone? Well, that's still for selfish reasons. So I advocate only using magic for spiritual development. For finding God as it originally was meant to be used.
But not to help some other person, not yourself, but someone else?
Maybe somebody else who practices magic would, but I would not feel comfortable doing it. I just feel it's so pure that it's to be used purely to find God and the angels.
Interesting, Joe. That is interesting.
I'm not pushing that on others, George, but that's just my personal feeling.
Because John, go ahead.
So even if you want to help someone, there's still a bit of selfishness involved, no matter how pure it is. And whenever there's that selfishness, you take away from God. That's just my opinion, you know?
When we come back, I want to talk about the Ark of the Covenant now. You've got some new information for us, I hear.
Yes. And Joe Parr, as you know, we talked about his work, gave me permission to release some of this, and it's just mind-blowing, in my opinion.
Right.
I think it's going to open up a whole new area of research.
All right. Stand by for that next on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, next hour we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Dr. John DeSalvo on Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, it's Glynis McCants, the Numbers Lady, wishing you a very happy holiday.
Ah, the Numbers Lady. I love that lady. John DeSalvo, back to you. Ark of the Covenant, what's new?
No, oh, before I forget, I want to thank you, by the way. You did something really nice to me. You invited me on Halloween night to tell a ghost story on your Ghost to Ghost program, and I really enjoyed that, and I thank you very much for that opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome indeed. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Ark of the Covenant, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is the research of Joe Parr, and, you know, on several shows we've talked about the work of Joe Parr, but maybe I can just... In a minute, just explain who he is for new listeners or people that haven't heard me. Joe Parr is one of the most incredible researchers, pyramid researchers, that ever lived. He's been an electronics engineer for over 40 years. He's currently retired, still carrying on pyramid research, and he's an inventor of the gamma ray transducer. He spent two nights on top of the pyramid, measuring electromagnetic levels. He was involved in a government project spanning the globe. He's got a JD degree, and I can go on and on. He's got really excellent credentials, and he was the one who discovered the energy bubble or orb around model pyramids and was able to show that they could block off all known types of radiation. So, you know, I don't want to obviously spend a couple hours talking about his research, but that was in my Decoding the Pyramid book and other shows that Joe was on. So just to put in perspective who he is. He also did work on research on ley lines and any kind of electrical or magnetic mystery. Joe seems to have gotten involved. So he decided to research the Ark of the Covenant. And again, I have to mention this is preliminary research on his part and, you know, subject to change, needs to be tested. But up to this point, you know, most ARC researchers that build a scale model of the ARC, they assume the ARC works by generating an electric charge, like a capacitor. You know, George, like there's wood, and then and it's lined by gold, right, inside and out. So it's like a conductor, which is the gold, separated by an insulator, which is the wood. And so you can build up a charge on one side, and then when you connect the conductors, you get this discharge of voltage. And some investigators have calculated you could get up to a voltage of 500 DC volts. And, you know, there's been all kinds of estimates. But people look at the ARC, have been looking at it as a weapon, in a sense, having storing a high electrical charge. So Joe built a scale model, about a 1/9 size scale model. He used copper instead of gold. It's both, you know, they're both conductors. He used some gold in manufacturing it. He modified it in a certain way, which I won't go into now, but he felt that this would have been the way the Israelites would have fashioned the Ark. And what was interesting, he also designed some special coils, which he could measure the voltage inside of the Ark. You know, this is his expertise, measuring these things. So so now he had the Ark, the model. He completely shut off the top, closed it up like it would be with a solid copper covering, and nothing was running on the Ark. It was just sitting there with a 1/9 model, you know, with a measuring device, and he's now measuring with his specially designed Ark to see if this would produce anything. And here's what was very, very interesting. Guess what was being produced in the inside of the Ark? Not a DC voltage, but an AC voltage, an alternating current, a sine wave was being produced in a low amplitude because the Ark was small, and, you know, who knows if a larger one would produce a bigger one.
Right.
But it's a alternating current. The Ark spontaneously generated an alternating current. Now,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Now, why this is so interesting is Joe used to measure the pyramid over years and years, 20 years. He measured this voltage, a sine wave voltage over a long period of time, and found out that it varied over a 28-day period. It's tied into the lunar cycle.
Now,
is it a coincidence that the Israelite calendar that the high priest used was a lunar calendar and not a solar calendar? This is my speculation. Maybe the priests in Jerusalem knew the ability and power of the Ark, and they knew that it was linked into the lunar cycle. So they wanted to base their religious holidays and their whole Hebrew religion on the lunar, another solar calendar. That's my speculation. I thought that was interesting.
You know, John, I sometimes think that the Ark is in the possession of some wealthy individual, and it's in his house somewhere.
You know, you never know. It's hidden somewhere. Somebody had already discovered it, whether it's a government that has it, like, you know, in the Indiana Jones movies. You know what? It could be right. Joe brought up something. Others have thought about this, that, you know, were there more than one Ark? Because if it was to be used for something. But I am now thinking, because of the sine wave and the way it's tied into the lunar cycle, that is the Ark some kind of device for opening up, like, a transmitter, like in the Indiana Jones movie, but opening up other worlds or opening up communications with angels or whatever, that it's actually not a weapon, but more something spiritually. Its role is more of a spiritual role. Who knows? And that was lost through time, and then the Ark has been lost. But I don't know. I have a speculation where I think the Ark is. I'm not trying to hear that.
Ethiopia? Where?
Well, you know, I've been working on a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is coming out by a large European publisher. And one interesting thing about the scrolls is that, you know, I don't know how much you know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's a copper scroll that was discovered.
Right.
And that was in Cave 3. And all the other scrolls were made of papyrus or other material. No scroll was made of copper. And in 1952, this copper scroll was found. It was broken in half. It was in a roll, and it was so brittle they couldn't unroll it. So they had to cut it in 23 narrow strips. And unfortunately, by the way, where they cut it, it's oxidizing. So, unfortunately. But the interesting thing about this scroll is there are over 3,000 Hebrew characters that were chiseled or punched out using a hammer. Again, it's on gold. Obviously, somebody thought it was very important. They wanted it to last a long time. They are on this scroll. They are 64 locations in Jerusalem and the surrounding area in which treasure and gold is buried, like national treasure, you know. It was like the temple treasure, people believe, and different estimates have been done. There have been some very famous scroll scholars that have tried to track it down and decipher locations. To give you an example, they're really specific, but we can't make out where exactly they're referring to. They tell you where to go, how much to dig. Like, for example, one of them says something like, in the ruins, which are in the Valley of Achor, under the steps, which go eastward, 40 rod cubics, you know, and the 17 talents of silver. I'm just kind of paraphrasing. They're buried. So it says, go here to the cistern, 10 feet, dig down so far, and you'll find so many talents of gold or whatever. So they're like specific directions with specific descriptions, and a lot of it seems to be the temple treasury in Jerusalem. Now, remember, the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and that's when what happened to everything, what happened to the Ark. People believe some of the Dead Sea Scrolls were from the library there in Jerusalem. And again, we don't know for sure. But I believe if the Ark was still there at that time, it was brought to the Dead Sea region, and that the Qumran community was responsible for hiding it. And it may turn up in one of the caves in the Dead Sea area. And I believe this copper scroll, by the way, the 64th location on this copper scroll, and this is very fascinating. Every other location, the 63 locations, all talk about a treasure. The 64th does not. The 64th says that this area does not have any treasure. But in the 64th location, it's a duplicate of this copper scroll that gives further explanations and measurements of the locations of the treasure. I speculate that this location could be the directions for the location of the Ark. Again, this is purely speculation, but it seems to, you know, it could fit in with some of the historical events. Again, you know, I may be completely off base on this, but as you know, I like to speculate and throw things out there. Somebody else may see a better link or a different link, or may see something stronger. But I think, I believe the Ark is still out there. I believe it will be found, but, you know, so far really nobody has found it. All the claims that, you know, Ethiopia, it seems like the more evidence of it being in Ethiopia is getting less and less. But again, we don't know. I think it's going to be in some isolated location that we didn't expect it, and I think this could be just as good as any. So, yeah, again, my speculation.
Some researchers, like Wendell Jones, claim that they know where it is, and they continue to search as well. I think, John, people have gotten close. I think it's in a certain region, if it's not already taken out in somebody's wealthy house somewhere.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think you need some adventurous person who can put the clues together and maybe go to the right location. And, in modern Indiana Jones. But, yeah, that's, you know, we talked about that with Egypt, too, in the Great Pyramid. You know, how do we know if the Hall of Records wasn't discovered, or some artifact or some papyrus that explains about the Great Pyramid and ancient Egyptian culture that is now sitting somewhere in some governmental office or some warehouse that will never see the light of day, you know?
What is the significance if the Ark of the Covenant is ever found?
You mean, what would be the significance if it was found, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, what does that do? What kind of a revelation would that be?
I don't know. It's a really good question. Well, I got to think about that one.
I mean, here's an example. If Noah's Ark is found, mm-hmm. then it basically tells you that the stories in the Bible are true, right?
Of course, yeah.
You would have to assume that, and that means
it would have historical significance, at least. Yes,
absolutely, and that means as incredible as Genesis, for example, is when you talk about fallen angels and the Nephilim and, you know, giants and things like that. If Noah's Ark is found, or the Ark of the Covenant is found, then I think it gives the entire Bible significance and historical perspective mm-hmm. that it is no longer, as some would say, a storybook, but a factual history book, and that is absolutely incredible for mankind.
It is, and I've always said that. You know, I may not take the Bible literally, but every story, a mythology, there's a historical fact involved in it, and I think you're right. For example, you know, I was involved with the Noah's Ark search for a while with the team, not actually an Ararat, but doing some research. And in fact, I still have an actual little piece of the wood that the Navarre expedition brought back, and I was going to do some studies on it. I knew Colonel Jim Irwin, you know, the astronaut that went up on Ararat. But I was, again, I'm like you mentioned, I'm very drawn to biblical mysteries, not necessarily to prove the Bible, but to find that historical match, that historical proof. And I do believe the Noah's Ark's a different story, but I think if the Ark of the Covenant is found, would be interesting, because I think it could be a working artifact that, you know, maybe we could get it going to what it originally did, whether it was a transmitter or was an energy source, or who knows what it could be. But that's one of my dreams, is that not only finding an artifact, but actually reconstructing and getting it to work to see what it did. Now, would, you know, a lot of interesting speculations. Would it open up a spiritual realm and maybe usher in a new age and show, you know, maybe that's always been my dream.
It's a teleportation device.
That's interesting, because I believe maybe the Great Pyramid, and Joe has that feeling about the Great Pyramid, could have been like that, a portal, a way to transport yourself to a different dimension or a different a realm. Look at superstring theory. It postulates the existence of many other dimensions. This is not science fiction. These things could exist scientifically, and I wish more scientists would be open and look at this. But you know, you've got very good points, George, that it'll bring science and I don't want to say religion, but spiritual themes and ideas together and show that there is a basis for this, a historical basis. And again, I believe this is man's destiny, is to find God, to find who he is and where he's going. And I also believe people that are open to the spiritual realm maybe walk in the footsteps of God better. They know that love is important because we're all part of God. They know of goodness is the most important thing and that we're all on a spiritual search together. Maybe that's what we need because, you know, materialistic things don't seem to do it. But maybe if spiritual enlightenment happened and maybe because of one of these artifacts were found, it would trigger something. Maybe that would be very important in the history of mankind. You know, it's a dream, but maybe a possibility.
Indeed. Are you still studying the Shroud of Turin?
Not really. I mean, I'm more or less by name, you know, on the research team, you know. But the only updates, you know, I mean, I try to keep up with what's going on and encourage others, but I'm really not actively involved after, I guess, 30 years now of it. I think, you know,
It's a long time, John.
Yeah, but the are scheduling. This is very interesting. When I was on your show, and I think about 5 or 6 months ago, I mentioned that they were going to have an exhibition in 2010.
Yeah.
A year or two ago, I told you it was 2025, and luckily they changed it to Pope Benedict XVI, changed it to 2010. And now the tentative dates are, and again, these could change, these are the last I've heard, are April 10th, 2010 to about mid-May. But the bad news is that the next day after the Pope mentioned the exhibition of the Shroud, the Archdiocese of Turin announced that there'll be no scientific examination during the public exhibition. So that was a very big disappointment.
Yeah, that is disappointing. Why would they do that?
I don't know. Unless they changed their mind. I mean, look, they changed their mind from 2025 to 2010, maybe between now and then. Maybe people are working behind the scenes to get something done. But for me as a scientist, I mean, that to me is even more important than a public exposition. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't say that, but I would love to see the carbon-14 testing done again. I'd love to see, more spectroscopy tests, all kinds of things, pollen, all the tests that were done back in 1978, a lot, 1978 was a certain type of technology. Now, 2010, there's been a big advance, you know, in 30 years in technology. Can you imagine what we could find out now? So, I was very disappointed on that. But, maybe it'll change.
Yep, maybe it shall, John. Maybe it shall. But who knows? Who knows?
Well, I think, you know, people sometimes ask me, are the relics important? Like, you know, whether it's the Shroud or the Ark or whatever. And I believe, you know, faith is a personal thing. And if an object like the Shroud or the Ark or Noah's Ark can help a person in their faith and their walk in life and to be a better person, I think it's great. But again, you know, you don't have to build your faith in any relic, because if the relic turns out to be a fake, you don't want to lose your faith. So I think it's fine. I mean, you know, we base a lot of our beliefs on certain things that help strengthen what we believe, but we don't necessarily take those things as God. So I think these things, you know, people use the statues and pictures of saints and Jesus and all kinds of holy figures to help, motivate them and encourage them to pray. So, you know, if this is a something of veneration that helps people, I think it's great. And I think, too, maybe the more we find out about these things, like you mentioned before, the more historical documentation we have, the more it starts to show that, these things are true. There are reality behind a lot of these supposedly stories or what people think are myths, that there are actually historical events associated with them. And, it gives new encouragement, I think, to people. That's my own kind of personal opinion.
All right, when we come back, we'll take phone calls next with Dr. John DeSalvo on Coast to Coast AM.